The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to journey back in time, so to speak, to enjoy a travel writer's efforts to follow a historic journey from the American Revolution. Then we're going to head south to learn about a town in Arkansas that is linked to a well-known family whose name is associated with a popular shopping venue. Retracing a war hero's audacious trek across the wilderness is our first story and is written by Richard Rubin. It contains visuals done by Tony Sinicola. Now, it was published in the May 7th, 2026 issue of the New York Times. And this particular story kicks off a Times series. It's titled Revolutionary Journeys and is dedicated to the Times coverage of the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, which we are celebrating this year. Now, Rubin's story is about a Boston bookseller who was ordered by General George Washington to fetch 60 tons of artillery. Now, just kind of put that in your head for a moment, huh? This so-called noble train of artillery is hauled across 300 miles of snowy wilderness and icy lakes between northern New York and Cambridge, Massachusetts. Now, author Richard Rubin set out to find all 60 historical markers that are posted along this historic trail today. And as he discovered, like the country, there has been a lot of changes since this historic mission was undertaken. So now let's learn some more as we begin his journey, okay? A century ago, when the automobile was still new and most thoroughfares were still dirt, two states decided to commemorate the most consequential road trip in American history, an epic slog undertaken 150 years earlier by a 25-year-old Boston bookseller named Henry Knox. Also, there were a bunch of other people, and horses, and oxen. Late fall 1775, George Washington had kept the British bottled up in Boston since spring, but he couldn't force them out. The city, pre-landfill, was just a bulbous mass in the harbor attached to the mainland by a slender isthmus. Washington, who held the mainland, lacked the big guns needed to bombard Boston and the ships supplying the thousands of British troops stationed there. In May, bands of patriots led by Benedict Arnold and Ethan Allen had captured two British forts in northern New York, Ticonderoga and Crown Point, and with them scores of cannons, mortars, and howitzers. Declaring no trouble or expense must be spared, Washington sent Knox to fetch them, armed with 1,000 pounds, that's about $193 in today's money, U.S. money, letters imploring other patriot commanders to assist him, and Knox's own prodigious knowledge of artillery, acquired over years of paging through his own inventory. The plan was to float the weapons, 60 tons worth, down Lake Champlain and George before they froze, then tow them overland on wooden sleds, cross hopefully by then frozen rivers, climb mountains, descend mountains, stop outside Boston to build carriages for them, wheel them to Cambridge, and hand them off to Washington, who in turn would haul them up to the heights of Dorchester under cover of darkness and drive the British off. So that's quite a unique part there. Now, several pictures are included as this in this part of the story, and I wanted to read some captions to give you a picture of what's going to happen. An aerial view of Fort Ticonderoga, a large gray stone fortress with red roof buildings covered in white snow. Many cannons are on the fort's walls. Now, Fort Ticonderoga, recently captured from the British along with Crown Point, provided patriots with scores of cannons and mortars and howitzers. Now, there's a cannon with a greenish patina that sits atop a red carriage with wooden wheels. And then we see some open books on a blue table showing illustrations of battle fortifications and mounted soldiers that would have been current in the 18th century. And these books were sold at Knox's shop, and it helped make him knowledgeable about artillery, and that includes cannons. Now we continue with the story. So we've already got this effort to get all this artillery moved. The war, of course, would go on, and Washington would lose a lot of battles. But the Knox Expedition, also known as the Noble Train of Artillery, a phrase Knox invoked in a missive to Washington, showed the British and the world that these rebels were resourceful, capable, determined, that they just might have a chance. It showed the rebels themselves something more. It's this key moment, Matthew Kegel, the curator at Fort Ticonderoga, explained, when the colonial upstarts are forced to work across their provincial boundaries, which in America in the 18th century are still very different. It led many to think of themselves for the first time, not just as New Yorkers or Massachusetts, but as Americans. So it makes sense that in 1926, the year of the sesquicentennial, these states decided to commemorate the expedition by installing markers at some 60 points along Knox's 300-mile route. But the landscape in the country had changed a great deal in the century and a half that had passed, and it has changed even more in the century since. Follow the trail today. It took me 4 days by car, writes the author, and you're at once traversing three American laid atop one another. Or three Americas laid atop one another, I should say. It's a trek that will leave you with a strong sense of just how impressive Knox's achievement was, and more significantly, of who and what we were and are. New York and Massachusetts installed 60 markers in 1926 along the route of the Knox expedition. The markers are humble stones, a few feet tall or so. They look alike, from the back anyway. Each state commissioned a distinct pictorial engraving for the front, and with very few exceptions, have identical inscriptions, but the scenery is always different. The trail starts with glorious natural vistas from the New York side of Lake Champlain, and ends overlooking Boston's skyline. In between, it runs through cities, suburbs, small towns, countryside, forest, and two mountain ranges, past small working farms and enormous defunct mills, multi-million-dollar vacation homes, and sagging tenements, shuttered shops, and lively boutiques in at least one casino. Some markers stand in the center of town, some in pocket parks, some along roadsides, and some in traffic triangles that are tricky to reach safely on foot. There are a list of them online with locations that are not always accurate. Nevertheless, with the exception of the two have disappeared, I managed to find them all. Now, one sits on what is now private property. It's at Sabbath Point, overlooking Lake George in New York. When I stopped by, the owners were away, but a neighbor who was shoveling his driveway assured me that they wouldn't mind my checking it out if I didn't mind tromping through knee-high snow to get to it. He was delighted that I was interested and proud that his neighborhood had played a part in the Knox expedition. They were bivouacked here, he explained. Originally from Britain, he retired to the area long after a career in education. It's a privilege to live here, he averred. Having recently watched Ken Burns' documentary on the American Revolution, he'd really come to appreciate how complicated that conflict was. The Revolution lingers like fog over parts of the trail, in bronze cannons and Minuteman statuary, and street and restaurant names. I had dinner one night at the Burgoyne Grill in Ticonderoga, New York. The British general, Gentleman Johnny Burgoyne, a man of refined taste, would have appreciated the bang-bang shrimp. Some places along Knox Trail have transformed in the last 250 years, and others look as much as they would have during the expedition. It hangs most heavily in Schuylerville, New York, seat of the Patriot General Philip Schuyler, whom Washington had asked to aid Knox, and part of the Saratoga battlefield, where in 1777 Horatio Gates and Benedict Arnold stunned Burgoyne by capturing his entire army, immensely boosting Patriot morale and prospects. A metal marker in the parking lot of a Chinese restaurant identifies it as the site of Burgoyne's breastworks. One on the front lawn of the high school marks the site of his camp. When school lets out, students make their way across the road to the Revolution Cafe, which proffers paninis named for Gates, Arnold, Schuyler, Burgoyne, and Thomas Paine. Schuylerville's Knox Trail marker stands among others in the town's small Veterans Memorial Park, and one reads, "Here, 1880, while excavating for Bullard Paper Chimney, The remains of an unknown soldier and his horse were exhumed. Saratoga itself inserts itself into the narrative elsewhere along the trail, like at a brick mansion near the Knox Marker in Kinderhook, New York, where Gentleman Johnny was entertained, per a different marker, on October 22, 1777, while being transported to Boston as a prisoner of war. It shows up on a green site of another Knox marker in West Springfield, Massachusetts, where the German general Friedrich Adolf Redesel and another Saratoga POW camp for a couple of days before crossing the Connecticut River. Outside Fort Edward, New York, I passed a historical marker pointing to the original burial spot of Jane McCrae, a loyalist who was abducted and scalped by Native Americans allied with the British, an incident that was exploited to tremendous effect in patriot propaganda, and as the man said, complicated. And there are more pictures. For example, there's a red brick church with a tall steeple that has a Knox marker in its front yard. And then we have another one in a snowy field. And then there's a plaque that's partly buried in the snow sitting on the median of a road next to signs saying no trucks, weight limit 5 tons, and slow children at play. Now back to the trail. I may have been the first person in years to regard some of these historical markers. Certainly I never not once saw anyone else pause at, much less read, a Knox trail marker. I don't know what all the sites looked like a century ago when those markers were installed, but the world around them has not stood still since then. The juxtapositions can be striking. One in the town of Lake George stands near an expansive leather outlet. The one in Mechanicsville, New York, sits in front of the town's squat Modern Community Services Center. The one in Latham, New York, is outside a squat Masonic temple. I believe Knox, a Freemason, would have approved of the location, if not the architecture. I found myself thinking about him throughout the journey, in weird ways. In Bolton Landing, New York, a summer destination on Lake George, the Knox marker sits in a waterside park. I spotted an older gentleman there sunbathing in a fuzzy hat, puffy parka, and camouflage cargo pants. It was 38 degrees behind a charming little public library, which was pretty much the only thing in town that was open in winter. Where would Knox have gotten lunch? I went without. In Framingham, Massachusetts, the marker stands behind a big and tall store, which reminded me of a song I learned as a child that began, 300 pounds of basso profundo was Henry Knox. Dr. Kegel insists he only weighed 280. In Waterford, New York, the marker stands on a little memorial green near a bridge over the Hudson. Knox certainly would have used a bridge or two. He had a rough time getting cannons across insufficiently thick ice, having to dredge up several after they crashed through. One may still sit at the bottom of the Mohawk River in Cohos, New York. Some sites, though, seem faded, like in Egremont, Massachusetts, a village just over the state line, where the marker sits outside the old Egremont Country Store, which looks and feels like something from a bygone Pepperidge Farm commercial. The woman who runs it pointed out, while making me bacon, egg, and cheese sandwiches, that it also serves as a post office. When someone gets a package, she explained, we put a slip in their box and leave it on the floor. There were several piles. Her husband mused about the Knox expedition as he rang me up. Can you imagine those guys doing that whole thing without maps, without roads? But you know what they did have? A lot of taverns. Well, that's true. A different kind of battle. And from those taverns, word spread. By the time the expedition reached Westfield, Massachusetts, where the Knox marker stands across the street from a Brazilian jiu-jitsu studio and a pierogi shop, locals were already ready for them. A great crowd swarmed the convoy. A ranger at the Springfield Armory, a National Park Service site, told me they wanted him to fire off the guns, he said. He kind of hesitated, and they said, come on, Henry, fire one off. So he picked a mortar and fired it, and they loved it. Knox did it a few more times, and then he and his crew were plied with food and drink till bedtime. It's not known if pierogies were served. Perhaps the people of Westfield were already patriots. Perhaps this unlikely expedition's unlikely progress won them over, giving them hope that this revolution might somehow succeed. What those travelers got as they were feted and aided along the way was a good picture of this nascent country they were helping to create. When their trail was plotted and marked 150 years later, much of what Knox and his teamsters saw had changed. Former frontier settlements had started luring holiday rusticators. Small towns were becoming comfortable suburbs for a new middle class. Larger towns had grown into cities, and farming villages had become industrial centers. The same rushing waters that had once ground grain now plowed textile looms, powered textile looms, and wood pulpers. Another century hence, many of those rustic retreats are now conspicuously posh. Some of those suburbs may have been more comfortable or grown more comfortable than the middle class can afford, or have become clusters of big box stores, fast food franchises, and automobile dealerships. The cities are still cities, if, excepting Boston, less vibrant and relevant than they were. But the upstate New York and western and central Massachusetts farm towns that bet on manufacturing appear from our current vantage to have lost the wager. In those places, I found Knox markers beside splintering schoolhouses and crumbling commercial blocks, near shabby government assistance bureaus and seedy package stores, across from empty storefronts outside which people hunched and shivering, waited in silence for a bus, or maybe for nothing. Yet these same towns also have stately old public libraries that are still the heart of the community, and proud historic homes where they paint may be peeling, but the walls remain solid. You get the sense, even just passing through, that the residents, though they know their town will probably never again be anything close to what it was, they haven't given up, that they, understanding they are unlikely to prevail, they fight on nonetheless, just like Henry Knox and George Washington did. Isn't that a great story? What an interesting thing to follow a historic trail and learn more from the markers and the people there. Well, we're going to probably hear more stories from the New York Times Revolutionary Journey series in future episodes of Armchair Travel, and we hope you'll be able to join us. As, again, it's all about celebrating the 250th anniversary of our nation's independence. And no doubt there will be other stories from other publications that we'll be able to read, too, so be listening. Next, we're going to hear from writer Emily Cochrane. Now, she covers the American South for the New York Times, and her story is part of the Times' ongoing travel series called 36 Hours. We've read several of those over the years on Armchair Traveler. This is an opportunity for writers to describe weekend visits to various cities and other locales around the world. And this one that we're going to read about is 36 Hours in Bentonville, Arkansas. It appeared in the May 7th, 2026 issue of the New York Times. So are you ready? Let's begin. How did Bentonville, a town of 61,000 in northwest Arkansas, become a national mecca for cycling and home to a world-class art museum? The answer largely is Walmart. The retail giant, which is headquartered here, and its founding family, the Waltons, have funneled millions into Bentonville's impressive attractions, which continue to expand. There is an undeniable blue and yellow corporate veneer to some aspects of the city. This June alone, the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art will add another 114,000 square feet. The new Oz Trails Bike Park, opening during the Bentonville Bike Festival, will unveil a mountain bike chairlift and 20 miles of trails. And the Bentonville Film Festival comes back to town. But beyond the obvious draws that made it one of the Times Travel's 52 places to go in 2026, it's the enthusiasm and hospitality of those who live and ride through Bentonville that have created a charming, accessible destination in the Ozark Mountains. And the author, Ms. Cochrane, gives us some key stops here. Take in the beauty of the Ozarks at the Kohler Mountain Bike Preserve, through miles of cycling and mountain biking paths for all abilities. Then you can wander through Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. The grounds include an expansive, vibrant collection of American art, sculpture trails, and a Frank Lloyd Wright house. And then we meander through the downtown square for an array of restaurants, shops, and boutiques, plus the Walmart Museum, of course. And as far as getting around Bentonville, well, a rental car is likely necessary to reach attractions beyond Bentonville's downtown radius, which is largely accessible on foot. Beyond the designated trails, cyclists can also enjoy clear bike lanes, racks across town, and the occasional tire pump. Rent one from cycling and outdoor shops like Fat Tire Bike Shop if you aren't able to bring your own. Now we're going to begin our 36-hour itinerary. We begin at 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and we find ourselves at the Museum of Native American History. And so that is the pair of gold-colored moccasins and a colorful, intricate beadwork and floral designs is what we see as we go through there. And then at 3 p.m., we're going to journey through Native American craft. And as you find your footing, the Museum of Native American History is a short jaunt west of downtown. It allows you to start at the very beginning. The compact museum is dedicated to the cultural traditions of indigenous groups across North America, with a collection of artifacts that dates back thousands of years. Stand in awe of Tusker, a composite woolly mammoth skeleton waiting just inside the front door, before wandering through five periods of the continent's early human history. There are hundreds of arrowheads, ornate feathered headdresses and quill work, and clay tools and bowls, all arranged in sequential tribute to traditions of craft and community. Children can also hunt for arrowheads outside as part of a scavenger hunt. Admission is free, but donations are encouraged. Now it's 4 p.m. We're going to head out to the Onyx Coffee Lab and stroll through the square. The heart of Bentonville is its square and its surrounding streets, lined with shops, restaurants, and naturally, an homage to Walmart. Linger on a bench with a latte for $6 from the award-winning Onyx Coffee Lab, a roastery that powers many of the coffee shops here. Peruse oil paintings and hand-blown glass sculptures by local artists at the Gallery Art on the Square. Pick up a pre-loved Read at Once Upon a Time books. Then pop into the freshly renovated Walmart Museum, it is free, and take stock of the evolution of a five-and-dime store to a multi-billion-dollar company. Yes, it is undeniably corporate and glowing, but offers a backstory to the money that helped build Bentonville. Beyond Walmart and Walton memorabilia, like returned products paired with the customer's objection, the museum also offers an interactive yet carefully curated conversation with a hologram of Sam Walton, the founder. Well, next we're going to find ourselves sitting around some wooden tables next to a white-tiled bar. It's called The Hive. It's 7 p.m., so let's go for upscale Southern food. Amid Bentonville's barbecue and classic Southern fare, upscale restaurants like The Hive and the lobby of the 21C Museum Hotel are at the forefront of the city's budding culinary scene. Snack on a ramekin of pimento cheese topped with bacon jam, that's cost $12, and then you can share dishes like a half chicken with olives and lemon for $44, and pecorino pasta with wild mushrooms for $29, and then you can take in the rotating art display in the lobby just outside the restaurant and keep an eye out for large plastic statues of green penguins that have become an unofficial mascot of the hotel. On to 9 o'clock on Friday night, we're going to drink at a velvet-lined speakeasy. A short walk across the square will bring you to Scotch and Soda, a bar with dozens of options for a whiskey drink. Dimly lit chandeliers, velvet curtains, and antler heads mounted on the brick walls help create a speakeasy air right off the downtown square. Have a classic old-fashioned for $12 or a more creative cocktail like the Kentucky Capo, a mix of rye whiskey, sambuca, a honey, lemon, orange bitters, and mint. That'll cost you $15, and you can watch the bartender scale a ladder to the ceiling for the more luxurious bottles. Well, now we transition from Friday to Saturday as we continue our tour of Bentonville. And we're going to take a look here. We see a picture of two folded crepes individually wrapped in parchment paper and foil, and they're sitting on metal containers on a metal table. We're at Crepes Paulette. It's 9 a.m., so let's fuel up with a handful handheld crepe. Peel back the parchment paper for a glimpse of the handheld buckwheat crepe inside and the crispy yet oozy mouthful, making it clear why Crepes Paulette burst out of a Bentonville-based food truck and into a brick-and-mortar location. The shop has a delectable array of savory or sweet filling combinations and no shortage of vegan options to be wrapped in crepes, crisped in either butter or oil. Can't decide? We'll get a savory mix of flavors. Rolled in a sweet crepe like the La Monte Cristo ham, cheddar, jam, and egg, it's $8.05 for small, or you can go large at $9.20. Well, at 10 a.m., it's time to check out the trails or hit the trails, and we're going to hit one near Crystal Bridges Museum. Millions of dollars have been funneled into the creation of Bentonville's impressive network of cycling trails, largely thanks to the shared mountain biking passions of Tom and Stuart Walton, grandsons of the Walmart founder. In the latest edition, Oz Trails Bike Park opens in June with 20 miles of trails and a hiking loop. It will also be the state's first mountain bike park with a chairlift. Until then, trails for any cycling ability or lack thereof can be found at Kohler Mountain Bike Preserve. Now, that's a 10-minute drive outside of downtown. Fly down rocky trails like Dirt Therapy, Good Vibrations, or Cleared for Takeoff, or walk or cycle leisurely among the strollers and dogs on the pedal assist. There's also a paved path to the open-air Airship Coffee Shop. It's 1 p.m., so we encounter people standing in front of a food truck, and there's a horror-themed art on it and a neon open sign. This is called the Witching Hour, so we're going to grab a horror-themed bite. True to its name, the Witching Hour food truck on the southwest side of downtown sticks to a horror theme year-round for its creatively named burgers. You can sit at a picnic bench covered in scary movie-themed stickers, enjoy a Feed Me Seymour with a veggie patty and vegan cheese for $15, or a bacon and cheddar-laden Candyman for $11, and then pair them with the zombie aioli sauce. Well, 2 p.m., let's explore the city's crown jewel of American art. It's possible to spend an entire day wandering through the world-class Crystal Bridges Museum, championed and funded by Alice Walton, another Walmart heir. In a sleek modern campus designed by the firm Safty Architects, its stunning collection of work of famous American artists in an unassuming location rivals that of some of the country's older coastal museums. Admission is free, except for the occasional seasonal exhibition. In June, the museum will unveil a 50% expansion of its grounds with more space for temporary exhibitions, a new contemporary gallery, and studio spaces. Outside, trails dotted with sculptures connect the gardens elsewhere in the city or take you back downtown about a mile south. And don't miss a 15-minute walkthrough of a house designed by architect Frank Lloyd Wright. It was carefully moved here from New Jersey. And by the way, even though it's free, a reservation is required. 5 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, and we see a glass of beer on a low table in a bar. And this glass has a logo of a seahorse on it. Well, that tells us it's time to fry. Yep, F-R-Y, 5 p.m., we're going to relax with a beer in a laid-back bar. Fry, a bar that opened in a former back alley barbershop by the square in February, offers a low-key, relaxed atmosphere akin to lounging in an old friend's garage. Prices here are about $55 for a beer, likely among the lowest to be found downtown. Bring a $1 bill. The barkeep keeps them pinned up, long-standing tradition championed by the bar owner and loyal guest. If you're craving a snack, there's a pastrami food truck just outside. Also that night, plan for supper at Wright's Barbecue and savor classic Arkansas barbecue. It's in northwest Arkansas with several locations. And then now on Sunday morning, well, diners are sitting in a restaurant looking at an airfield. We find ourselves at 8 a.m. watching the planes taking off over breakfast on the edge of Thaden Fieldhouse Airstrip, which is just outside of town. And that, my friends, is going to bring us to the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. We certainly hope you've enjoyed it and you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and remind you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.